I still thought his best chance was to engage a lawyer and try for the retrial. Anything to get out from under Norton's thumb. Maybe Tommy Williams could be shut up by nothing more than a cushy furlough program, but I wasn't entirely sure. Maybe a good old Mississippi hard-ass lawyer could crack him. And maybe that lawyer wouldn't even have to work that hard. Williams had honestly liked Andy. Every now and then I'd bring these points up to Andy. He would only smile, his eyes far away, and say he was thinking about it. Apparently, he'd been thinking about a lot of other things as well. In 1975, Andy Dufresne escaped from Shawshank. He hasn't been recaptured, and I don't think he ever will be. In fact, I don't think Andy Dufresne even exists anymore. But I think there's a man down in Zihuatanejo, Mexico, named Peter Stevens, probably running a very new small hotel in this year of our Lord, 1976. I'll tell you what I know and what I think. That's about all I can do, isn't it? On March 12, 1975, the cell doors in cell block 5 opened at 6:30 a.m., as they do every morning around here except Sunday. And as they do every day except Sunday, the inmates of those cells stepped forward into the corridor and formed two lines as the cell doors slammed shut behind them. They walked up to the main cell block gate, where they were counted off by two guards before being sent on down to the cafeteria for a breakfast of oatmeal, scrambled eggs, and fatty bacon. All of this went according to routine until the count at the cell block gate. There should have been 27. Instead, there were 26. After a call to the captain of the guard, cell block 5 was allowed to go to breakfast. The captain of the guards, a not-half-bad fellow named Richard Gagnard, and his assistant, a jolly prick named Dave Burks, came down to cell block 5 right away. Gagnard reopened the cell doors, and he and Burks went down the corridor together, dragging their sticks over the bars, their guns out. In a case like that, what you usually have is someone who has been taken sick in the night, so sick he can't even step out of his cell in the morning. More rarely, someone has died or committed suicide. But this time they found a mystery instead of a sick man or a dead man. They found no man at all. There were 14 cells in cell block 5, 7 to a side, all fairly neat. Restriction of visiting privileges is the penalty for a sloppy cell at Shawshank, and all very empty. Gagnard's first assumption was that there had been a miscount, or a practical joke. So instead of going off to work after breakfast, the inmates of cell block 5 were sent back to their cells, joking and happy. Any break in the routine was always welcome. Cell doors opened, prisoners stepped in, cell doors closed, some clown shouting, "I want my lawyer, I want my lawyer, you guys run this place just like a frigging prison." Burks, "Shut up in there or I'll rank you." The clown, "I rank your wife, Berkey." Gagne, "Shut up, all of you, or you'll spend a day in there." He and Burks went up the line again, counting noses. They didn't have to go far. "Who belongs in this cell?" Gagne asked the right-side night guard. "Andrew Dufresne," the right-side answered. And that was all it took. Everything stopped being routine right then. The balloon went up. In all the prison movies I've ever seen, this wailing horn goes off when there's been a break. That never happens at Shawshank. The first thing Gagne did was to get in touch with the warden. The second thing was to get a search of the prison going. The third was to alert the state police in Scarborough to the possibility of a breakout. That was the routine. It didn't call for them to search the suspected escapee's cell, and so no one did. Not then. Why would they? It was a case of what you see is what you get. It was a small square room, bars on the windows and bars on the sliding door. There was a toilet and an empty cot, some pretty rocks on the windowsill. And the poster, of course. It was Linda Ronstadt by then. The poster was right over his bunk. There had been a poster there in that exact same place for 26 years. And when someone... It was Warden Norton himself, as it turned out, poetic justice if there ever was any, looked behind it. They got one hell of a shock. But that didn't happen until 6:30 that night, almost 12 hours after Andy had been reported missing, probably 20 hours after he had actually made his escape. Norton hit the roof. I have it on good authority Chester, the trustee, was waxing the hall floor in the admin wing that day. He didn't have to polish any key plates with his ear that day. He said you could hear the warden clear down to records and files as he chewed on Rich Garnier's ass. "What do you mean you're satisfied he's not on the prison grounds? What does that mean? It means you didn't find him. You better find him. You better, because I want him. Do you hear me? I want him." Gagne said something. "Didn't happen on your shift, that's what you say. So far as I can tell, no one knows when it happened, or how, or if it really did. Now I want him in my office by 3 o'clock this afternoon, or some heads are going to roll. I can promise you that, and I always keep my promises." Something else from Gagne, something that seemed to provoke Norton to even greater rage. "No? Then look at this. Look at this. You recognize it? Last night's tally for cell block 5. Every prisoner accounted for. Dufresne was locked up last night at 9, and it is impossible for him to be gone now. It is impossible now you find him." But at 3 that afternoon, Andy was still among the missing. Norton himself stormed down to cell block 5 a few hours later, where the rest of us had been locked up all of that day. Had we been questioned? We had spent most of that long day being questioned by harried screws who were feeling the breath of the dragon on the backs of their necks. We all said the same thing. We had seen nothing, heard nothing. And so far as I know, we were all telling the truth. I know that I was. All we could say was Andy had indeed been in his cell at the time of the lock-in, and it lights out an hour later. One wit suggested that Andy had poured himself out through the keyhole. The suggestion earned the guy 4 days in solitary. They were uptight. So Norton came down, stalked down, glaring at us with blue eyes nearly hot enough to strike sparks from the tempered steel bars of our cages. He looked at us as if he believed we were all in on it. Probably he did believe it. He went into Andy's cell and looked around. It was just as Andy had left it, the sheets on his bunk turned back, but without looking slept in. Rocks on the windowsill, but not all of them. The ones he liked best he took with him. "Rocks!" Norton hissed, and swept them off the window ledge with a clatter. Gagne, who was now on overtime, winced, but said nothing. Norton's eyes fell on the Linda Ronstadt poster. Linda was looking back over her shoulder, her hands tucked into the back pockets of a very tight pair of fawn-colored slacks. She was wearing a halter, and she had a deep California tan. It must have offended the hell out of Norton's Baptist sensibilities, that poster. Watching him glare at it, I remembered what Andy had once said about feeling he could almost step through the picture and be with the girl. In a very real way, that was exactly what he did, as Norton was only seconds from discovering. "Wretched thing!" he grunted and ripped the poster from the wall with a single swipe of his hand, and revealed the gaping, crumbled hole in the concrete behind it. Gagne wouldn't go in. Norton ordered him. God, they must have heard Norton ordering Rich Gagne to go in there all over the prison. And Gagne just refused him, point blank. "I'll have your job for this," Norton screamed. He was as hysterical as a woman having a hot flash. He had utterly blown his cool. His neck had turned a rich, dark red, and two veins stood out throbbing on his forehead. "You can count on it, you Frenchman. I'll have your job, and I'll see to it that you never get another one in any prison system in New England." Gagne silently held out his service pistol to Norton, but first, he'd had enough. He was then 2 hours overtime, going on 3, and he just had enough. It was as if Andy's defection from our happy little family had driven Norton right over the edge of some private irrationality that had been there for a long time. Certainly he was crazy that night. I don't know what that private irrationality might have been, of course, but I do know that there were 26 cons listening to Norton's little dust-up with Rich Gagne that evening, as the last of the light faded from a dull late winter sky. All of us hard-timers and long-line riders who had seen the administrators come and go, the hard-asses and the candy-asses alike, and we all knew that Warden Samuel Norton had just passed what the engineers like to call the breaking strain. And by God, it almost seemed to me that somewhere I could hear Andy Dufresne laughing. Norton finally got a skinny drink of water on the night shift to go into the hole that had been behind Andy's poster of Linda Ronstadt. The skinny guard's name was Rory Tremont, and he was not exactly a ball of fire in the brains department. Maybe he thought he was going to win a Bronze Star or something. As it turned out, he was fortunate that Norton got someone of Andy's approximate height and build to go in there. If they had sent a big-assed fella, as most prison guards seem to be, the guy would have stuck in there as sure as God made green grass, and might be there still. Tremont went in with a nylon filament rope, which someone had found in the trunk of his car, tied around his waist, and a big 6-battery flashlight in one hand. By then, Gagne, who had changed his mind about quitting and who seemed to be the only one there still able to think clearly, had dug out a set of blueprints. I knew well enough what they showed him, a wall which looked in cross-section like a sandwich. The entire wall was 10 feet thick. The inner and outer sections were each about 4 feet thick. In the center was 2 feet of pipe space, and you want to believe that was the meat of the thing, in more ways than one. Tremont's voice came out of the hole, sounding hollow and dead. "Something smells awful in here, Warden." "Never mind that. Keep going." Tremont's lower legs disappeared into the hole. A moment later, his feet were gone, too. His light flashed dimly back and forth. "Warden, it smells pretty damn bad." "Never mind, I said," Norton cried. Dolorously, Tremont's voice floated back. "Smells like shit. Oh, God, that's what it is. It's shit. Oh, my God, let me out of here. I'm going to blow my groceries. Oh, shit, it's shit. Oh, my God." And then came the unmistakable sound of Rory Tremont losing his last couple of meals. Well, that was it for me. I couldn't help myself. The whole day, hell no, the last 30 years, all came up on me at once, and I started laughing fit to split. A laugh such as I'd never had since I was a free man. The kind of laugh I never expected to have inside these gray walls, and oh, dear God, didn't it feel good. "Get that man out of here," Warden Norton was screaming, and I was laughing so hard I didn't know if he meant me or Tremont. I just went on laughing and kicking my feet and holding onto my belly. I couldn't have stopped if Norton had threatened to shoot me dead bang on the spot. "Get him out!" Well, friends and neighbors, I was the one who went. Straight down to solitary, and there I stayed for 15 days. A long shot. But every now and then I'd think about the poor old, not too bright, Rory Tremont bellowing, "Oh, shit, it's shit!" And then I'd think about Andy Dufresne heading south in his own car, dressed in a nice suit, and I'd just have to laugh. I did that 15 days in solitary, practically standing on my head. Maybe because half of me was with Andy Dufresne. Andy Dufresne, who had waded in shit and came out clean on the other side. Andy Dufresne, headed for the Pacific. I heard the rest of what went on that night from half a dozen sources. There wasn't all that much, anyway. I guess that Rory Tremont decided he didn't have much left to lose after he had lost his lunch and dinner, because he did go on. There was no danger of falling down the pipe shaft between the inner and outer segments of the cell block wall. It was so narrow that Tremont actually had to wedge himself down. He said later that he could only take half breaths, and that he knew what it would be like to be buried alive. What he found at the bottom of the shaft was a master sewer pipe which served the 14 toilets in cell block 5, a porcelain pipe that had been laid 33 years before. It had been broken into. Beside the jagged hole in the pipe, Tremont found Andy's rock hammer. Andy had gotten free, but it hadn't been easy. The pipe was even narrower than the shaft Tremont had just descended. Rory Tremont didn't go in, and so far as I know, no one else did either. It must have been damn near unspeakable. A rat jumped out of the pipe as Tremont was examining the hole in the rock hammer, and he swore later that it was nearly as big as a cocker spaniel pup. He went back up the crawl space to Andy's cell like a monkey on a stick. Andy had gone into that pipe. Maybe he knew that it emptied into a stream 500 yards beyond the prison on the marshy western side. I think he did. The prison blueprints were around, and Andy would have found a way to look at them. He was a methodical cuss. He would have known, or found out, that the sewer pipe running out of cell block 5 was the last one in Shawshank not hooked into the new waste treatment plant. And he would have known it was do it by mid-1975, or do it never, because in August they were going to switch us over to the new waste treatment plant, too. 500 yards. The length of 5 football fields. Just shy of 0.5 mile. He crawled that distance, maybe with one of those small pen lights in his hand, maybe with nothing but a couple of books of matches. He crawled through foulness that I either can't imagine or don't want to imagine. Maybe the rats scattered in front of him, or maybe they went for him, the way such animals sometimes will when they've had a chance to grow bold in the dark. He must have had just enough clearance at the shoulders to keep moving, and he probably had to shove himself through the places where the lengths of pipe were joined. If it had been me, the claustrophobia would have driven me mad 12 times over. But he did it. At the far end of the pipe, they found a set of muddy footprints leading out of the sluggish, polluted creek the pipe fed into. 2 miles from there, a search party found his prison uniform. That was a day later. The story broke big in the papers, as you might guess, but no one within a 15-mile radius of the prison stepped forward to report a stolen car, stolen clothes, or a naked man in the moonlight. There was not so much as a barking dog in a farmyard. He came out of the sewer pipe, and he disappeared like smoke. But I am betting he disappeared in the direction of Buxton. 3 months after that memorable day, Warden Norton resigned. He was a broken man, it gives me great pleasure to report. The spring was gone from his step. On his last day, he shuffled out, with his head down, like an old con shuffling down to the infirmary for his codeine pills. It was Gagne who took over, and to Norton that must have seemed like the unkindest cut of all. For all I know, Sam Norton is down there in Elliott now, attending services at the Baptist Church every Sunday and wondering how the hell Andy Dufresne ever could have gotten the better of him. I could have told him. The answer to the question is simplicity itself. Some have got it, Sam, and some don't, and never will. That's what I know. Now I'm going to tell you what I think. I may have it wrong on some of the specifics, but I'd be willing to bet my watch and chain that I've got the general outline down pretty well. Because with Andy being the sort of man that he was, there's only one or two ways that it could have been. And every now and then, when I think it out, I think of Normandin, that half-crazy Indian. "Nice fella," Normandin had said after selling with Andy for 8 months. "I was glad to go, me. Bad draft in that cell. All the time cold. He don't let nobody touch his things. That's okay. Nice man. Never made fun. But big draft." Poor, crazy Normandin. He knew more than all the rest of us, and he knew it sooner. And it was 8 long months before Andy could get him out of there and have the cell to himself again. If it hadn't been for the 8 months Normandin had spent with him after Warden Norton first came in, I do believe that Andy would have been free before Nixon resigned. I believe now that it began in 1949. Way back then. Not with the rock hammer, but with the Rita Hayworth poster. I told you how nervous he seemed when he asked for that. Nervous and filled with suppressed excitement. At the time, I thought it was just embarrassment, that Andy was the sort of guy who'd never want someone else to know that he had feet of clay and wanted a woman, especially if it was a fantasy woman. But I think now that I was wrong. I think now that Andy's excitement came from something else altogether. What was responsible for the hole that Warden Norton eventually found behind the poster of a girl that hadn't even been born when that photo of Rita Hayworth was taken? Andy Dufresne's perseverance and hard work, yeah, I don't take any of that away from him. But there were 2 other elements in the equation, a lot of luck and WPA concrete. You don't need me to explain the luck, I guess. The WPA concrete I checked out for myself. I invested some time in a couple of stamps and wrote first to the University of Maine History Department and then to a fellow whose address they were able to give me. This fellow had been foreman of the WPA project that built the Shawshank Max Security Wing. The wing, which contained cell blocks 3, 4, and 5, was built in the years 1934 to 1937. Now, most people don't think of cement and concrete as technological developments, the way we think of cars and oil furnaces and rocket ships, but they really are. There was no modern cement until 1870 or so, and no modern concrete until after the turn of the century. Mixing concrete is as delicate a business as making bread. You can get it too watery, or not watery enough. You can get the sand mix too thick or too thin, and the same is true of the gravel mix. And back in 1934, the science of mixing this stuff was a lot less sophisticated than it is today. The walls of cell block 5 were solid enough, but they weren't exactly dry and toasty. As a matter of fact, they were and are pretty damn dank. After a long wet spell, they would sweat and sometimes even drip. Cracks had a way of appearing, some an inch deep. They were routinely mortared over. Now here comes Andy Dufresne into cell block 5. He's a man who graduated from the University of Maine School of Business, but he's also a man who took two or three geology courses along the way. Geology had, in fact, become his chief hobby. I imagine it appealed to his patient, meticulous nature. A 10,000-year ice age here, a million years of mountain building there, plates of bedrock grinding against each other deep under the earth's skin over the millennia. Pressure. Andy told me once that all of geology is the study of pressure. And time, of course. He had time to study those walls, plenty of time. When the cell door slams and the lights go out, there's nothing else to look at. First-timers usually have a hard time adjusting to the confinement of prison life. They get screw fever. Sometimes they have to be hauled down to the infirmary and sedated a couple of times before they get on the beam. It's not unusual to hear some new member of our happy little family banging on the bars of his cell and screaming to be let out. And before the cries have gone on for long, the chant starts up along the cell block, "Fresh fish! Hey, little fishy, fresh fish, fresh fish, got fresh fish today." Andy didn't flip out like that when he came to the shank in 1948, but that's not to say he didn't feel many of the same things. He may have come close to madness, some do, and some go sailing right over the edge. Old life blown away in the wink of an eye, indeterminate nightmare stretching out ahead, a long season in hell. "So what did he do, I ask you?" He searched almost desperately for something to divert his restless mind. Oh, there are all sorts of ways to divert yourself, even in prison. It seems like the human mind is full of an infinite number of possibilities when it comes to diversion. I told you about the sculptor and his three ages of Jesus. There were coin collectors who were always losing their collections to thieves, stamp collectors, one fellow who had postcards from 35 different countries, and let me tell you, he would have turned out your lights if he'd caught you diddling with his postcards. Andy got interested in rocks and the walls of his cell. I think that his initial intention might have been to do no more than to carve his initials into the wall where the poster of Rita Hayworth would soon be hanging. His initials, or maybe a few lines from some poem. Instead, what he found was that interestingly weak concrete. Maybe he started to carve his initials and a big chunk of the wall just fell out. I can see him, lying there on his bunk, looking at that broken chunk of concrete, turning it over in his hands. Never mind the wreck of your whole life. Never mind that you got railroaded into this place by a whole trainload of bad luck. Let's forget all that and look at this piece of concrete. Some months further along, he might have decided it would be fun to see how much of that wall he could take out. But you can't just start digging into your wall. And then, when the weekly inspection, or one of the surprise inspections that are always turning up interesting caches of booze, drugs, dirty pictures, and weapons, comes around, say to the guard, "This? Just excavating a little hole in my cell wall, not to worry, my good man." No, he couldn't have that. So he came to me and asked if I could get him a Rita Hayworth poster. Not a little one, but a big one. And, of course, he had the rock hammer. I remember thinking, when I got him that gadget back in 48, that it would take a man 600 years to burrow through the wall with it. True enough. But Andy only had to go through half the wall. And even with the soft concrete, it took him 2 rock hammers and 27 years to do it. Of course, he lost most of one of those years to Normandin, and he could only work at night, preferably late at night, when almost everybody is asleep, including the guards who worked the night shift. But I suspect the thing which slowed him down the most was getting rid of the wall as he took it out. He could muffle the sound of his work by wrapping the head of his hammer in rock-polishing cloth, but what to do with the pulverized concrete and the occasional chunks that came out whole? I think he must have broken up the chunks into pebbles, and I remember the Sunday after I'd gotten him the rock hammer. I remember watching him walk across the exercise yard, his face puffy from his latest go-round with the sisters. I saw him stoop, pick up a pebble, and it disappeared up his sleeve. That inside sleeve pocket is an old prison trick. Up your sleeve or just inside the cuff of your pants. And I have another memory, very strong, but unfocused, maybe something I saw more than once. This memory is of Andy Dufresne walking across the exercise yard on a hot summer day when the air was utterly still. Still. Yeah. Except for the little breeze that seemed to be blowing sand around Andy Dufresne's feet. So maybe he had a couple of cheetahs in his pants below the knees. You loaded the cheetahs up with fill and then just strolled around, your hands in your pockets. And when you felt safe and unobserved, you gave the pockets a little twitch. The pockets, of course, are attached by string or strong thread to the cheetahs. The fill goes cascading out of your pants legs as you walk. The World War II POWs who were trying to tunnel out used the dodge. The years went past, and Andy brought his wall out to the exercise yard, cupful by cupful. He played the game with administrator after administrator, and they thought it was because he wanted to keep the library growing. I have no doubt that was part of it, but the main thing Andy wanted was to keep Cell 14 in Cell Block 5 a single occupancy. I doubt if he had any real plans or hopes of breaking out, at least not at first. He probably assumed the wall was 10 feet of solid concrete, and that if he succeeded in boring all the way through it, he'd come out 30 feet over the exercise yard. But, like I say, I don't think he was worried over much about breaking through. His assumption would have run this way. I'm only making a foot of progress every 7 years or so. Therefore, it would take me 70 years to break through. That would make me 101 years old. Here's a second assumption I would have made had I been Andy. That eventually I'd be caught and get a lot of solitary time, not to mention a very large black mark on my record. After all, there was the regular weekly inspection and a surprise toss, which usually came at night every second week or so. He must have decided that things couldn't go on for long. Sooner or later, some screw was going to peek behind Rita Hayworth just to make sure Andy didn't have a sharpened spoon handle or some marijuana reefers scotch-taped to the wall. And his response to that second assumption must have been, to hell with it. Maybe he even made a game out of it. How far in can I get before they find out? Prison is a goddamn boring place, and the chance of being surprised by an unscheduled inspection in the middle of the night while he had his poster unstuck probably added some spice to his life during the early years. And I do believe it would have been impossible for him to get away with it just on dumb luck. Not for 27 years. Nevertheless, I have to believe that for the first 2 years, until mid-May of 1950, when he helped Byron Hadley get around the tax on his windfall inheritance, that's exactly what he did get by on. Or maybe he had something more than dumb luck going for him, even back then. He had money, and he might have been slipping someone a little squeeze every week to take it easy on him. Most guards will go along with that if the price is right. It's money in their pockets, and the prisoner gets to keep his whack-off pictures or his tailor-made cigarettes. Also, Andy was a model prisoner. Quiet, well-spoken, respectful, non-violent. It's the crazies and the stampeders that get their cells turned upside down at least once every 6 months, their mattresses unzipped, their pillows taken away and cut open, the outflow pipe from their toilets carefully probed. Then, in 1950, Andy became something more than a model prisoner. In 1950, he became a valuable commodity, a murderer who did tax returns better than H&R Block. He gave gratis estate planning advice, set up tax shelters, filled out loan applications, sometimes creatively. I can remember him sitting behind his desk in the library, patiently going over a car loan agreement, paragraph by paragraph, with a screwhead who wanted to buy a used DeSoto, telling the guy what was good about the agreement and what was bad about it, explaining to him that it was possible to shop for a loan and not get hit quite so bad, steering him away from the finance companies, which in those days were sometimes little better than legal loan sharks. When he'd finished, the screwhead started to put out his hand, and then drew it back to himself quickly. He'd forgotten for a moment, you see, that he was dealing with a mascot, not a man. Andy kept up on the tax laws and the changes in the stock market, and so his usefulness didn't end after he'd been in cold storage for a while, as it might have done. He began to get his library money. His running war with the sisters had ended, and nobody tossed his cell very hard. He was a good nigger. Then one day, very late in the going, perhaps around October of 1967, the long-time hobby suddenly turned into something else. One night, while he was in the hole up to his waist with Raquel Welch hanging down over his ass, the pick end of his rock hammer must have suddenly sunk into concrete past the hilt. He would have dragged some chunks of concrete back, but maybe he heard others falling down into that shaft, bouncing back and forth, clinking off that standpipe. Did he know by then that he was going to come upon that shaft, or was he totally surprised? I don't know. He might have seen the prison blueprints by then, or he might not have. If not, you can be damned sure he found a way to look at them not long after. All at once, he must have realized that instead of just playing a game, he was playing for high stakes. In terms of his own life and his own future, the highest. Even then, he couldn't have known for sure, but he must have had a pretty good idea, because it was right around then that he talked to me about Zihuatanejo for the first time. All of a sudden, instead of just being a toy, that stupid hole in the wall became his master. If he knew about the sewer pipe at the bottom and that it led under the outer wall, it did, anyway. He'd had the key under the rock in Buxton to worry about for years. Now he had to worry that some eager beaver new god would look behind his poster and expose the whole thing, or that he would get another cellmate, or that he would, after all those years, suddenly be transferred. He had all those things on his mind for the next 8 years. All I can say is that he must have been one of the coolest men who ever lived. I would have gone completely nuts after a while, living with all that uncertainty. But Andy just went on playing the game. He had to carry the possibility of discovery for another 8 years. The probability of it, you might say, because no matter how carefully he stacked the cards in his favor, as an inmate of a state prison, he just didn't have that many to stack. And the gods had been kind to him for a very long time, some 19 years. The most ghastly irony I can think of would have been if he had been offered a parole. Can you imagine it? 3 days before the parolee is actually released, he is transferred into the light security wing to undergo a complete physical and a battery of vocational tests. While he's there, his old cell is completely cleaned out. Instead of getting his parole, Andy would have gotten a long turn downstairs in solitary, followed by some more time upstairs, but in a different cell. If he broke into the shaft in 1967, how come he didn't escape until 1975? I don't know for sure, but I can advance some pretty good guesses. First, he would have become more careful than ever. He was too smart to just push ahead at flank speed and try to get out in 8 months, or even in 18. He must have gone on widening the opening on the crawl space a little at a time, a hole as big as a teacup by the time he took his New Year's Eve drink that year. A hole as big as a dinner plate by the time he took his birthday drink in 1968. As big as a serving tray by the time the 1969 baseball season opened. For a time, I thought it should have gone much faster than it apparently did. After he broke through, I mean. It seemed to me that instead of having to pulverize the crap and take it out of his cell in the cheetah gadgets I have described, he could simply let it drop down the shaft. The length of time he took makes me believe that he didn't dare do that. He might have decided that the noise would arouse someone's suspicions. Or, if he knew about the sewer pipe, as I believe he must have, he would have been afraid that a falling chunk of concrete would break it before he was ready, screwing up the cell block sewage system and leading to an investigation. And an investigation, needless to say, would lead to ruin. Still and all, I'd guess that by the time Nixon was sworn in for his second term, the hole would have been wide enough for him to wriggle through. And probably sooner than that. And he was a small guy. Why didn't he go, then? That's where my educated guesses run out, folks. From this point, they become progressively wilder. One possibility is that the crawl space itself was clogged with crap and he had to clear it out. But that wouldn't account for all the time. So what was it? I think that maybe Andy got scared. I've told you, as well as I can, how it is to be an institutional man. At first you can't stand those four walls. Then you get so you can abide them. Then you get so you accept them. And then, as your body and your mind and your spirit adjust to life on an HO scale, you get to love them. You're told when to eat, when you can write letters, when you can smoke. If you're at work in the laundry or the plate shop, you're assigned 5 minutes of each hour when you can go to the bathroom. For 35 years, my time was 25 minutes after the hour, and after 35 years, that's the only time I ever felt the need to take a piss or have a crap. 25 minutes past the hour. And if for some reason I couldn't go, the need would pass at 30 after and come back at 25 past the next hour. I think Andy may have been wrestling with that tiger, that institutional syndrome, and also with the bulking fears that all of it might have been for nothing. How many nights must he have lain awake under his poster thinking about that sewer line, knowing the one chance was all he'd ever get? The blueprints might have told him how big the pipe's bore was, but a blueprint couldn't tell him what it would be like inside that pipe. If he would be able to breathe without choking, if the rats were big enough and mean enough to fight instead of retreating, and a blueprint couldn't have told him what he'd find at the end of the pipe when and if he got there. Here's a joke even funnier than the parole would have been. Andy breaks into the sewer line, crawls through 500 yards of choking, shit-smelling darkness, and comes up against a heavy-gauge mesh screen at the end of it all. Ha ha, very funny. That would have been on his mind. And if the long shot actually came in and he was able to get out, would he be able to get some civilian clothes and get away from the vicinity of the prison undetected? Last of all, suppose he got out of the pipe, got away from Shawshank before the alarm was raised, got to Buxton, overturned the right rock, and found nothing beneath. Not necessarily something so dramatic as arriving at the right field and discovering that a high-rise apartment building had been erected on the spot, or that it had been turned into a supermarket parking lot. It could have been that some little kid who liked rocks noticed that piece of volcanic glass, turned it over, saw the deposit box key, and took both it and the rock back to his room as souvenirs. Maybe a November hunter kicked the rock, left the key exposed, and a squirrel or a crow with a liking for bright, shiny things had taken it away. Maybe there had been spring floods one year, breaching the wall, washing the key away. Maybe anything. So I think, wild guess or not, that Andy just froze in place for a while. After all, you can't lose if you don't bet. What did he have to lose, you ask? His library, for one thing, the poison piece of institutional life for another, any future chance to grab his safe identity. But he finally did it, just as I have told you. He tried, and my, didn't he succeed in spectacular fashion, you tell me. But did he get away, you ask? What happened after? What happened when he got to that meadow and turned over that rock, always assuming the rock was still there? I can't describe that scene for you, because this institutional man is still in this institution and expects to be for years to come. But I'll tell you this. Very late in the summer of 1975, on September 15th to be exact, I got a postcard which had been mailed from the tiny town of McNary, Texas. That town is on the American side of the border, directly across from El Porvenir. The message side of the card was totally blank. But I know. I know it in my heart as surely as I know that we're all going to die someday. McNary was where he crossed. McNary, Texas. So that's my story, Jack. I never believed how long it would take to write it all down, or how many pages it would take. I started writing just after I got that postcard, and here I am finishing up on January 14th, 1976. I've used 3 pencils right down to knuckle stubs and the whole tablet of paper. I've kept the pages carefully hidden, not that many could read my hen tracks anyway. It stirred up more memories than I ever would have believed. Writing about yourself seems to be a lot like sticking a branch into clear river water and roiling up the muddy bottom. Well, you weren't writing about yourself, I hear someone in the peanut gallery saying. You were writing about Andy Dufresne. You're nothing but a minor character in your own story. But, you know, that's just not so. It's all about me, every damned word of it. Andy was the part of me they could never lock up, the part of me that will rejoice when the gates finally open for me and I walk out in my cheap suit with my $20 of mad money in my pocket. That part of me will rejoice no matter how old and broken and scared the rest of me is. I guess it's just that Andy had more of that part than me, and used it better. There are others here like me, others who remember Andy. We're glad he's gone, but a little sad, too. Some birds are not meant to be caged, that's all. Their feathers are too bright, their songs too sweet and wild. So you let them go. Or when you open the cage to feed them, they somehow fly out past you. And the part of you that knows it was wrong to imprison them in the first place rejoices, but still the place where you live is that much more drab and empty for their departure. That's the story, and I'm glad I told it, even if it is a bit inconclusive, and even though some of the memories the pencil prodded up like that branch poking up the river mud made me feel a little sad and even older than I am. Thank you for listening. And Andy, if you're really down there, as I believe you are, look at the stars for me just after sunset, and touch the sand, and wade in the water, and feel free. I never expected to take up this narrative again, but here I am with the dog-eared folded pages open on the desk in front of me. Here I am adding another 3 or 4 pages, writing in a brand new tablet, a tablet I bought in a store. I just walked into a store on Portland's Congress Street and bought it. I thought I had put finish to my story in a Shawshank prison cell on a bleak January day in 1976. Now it's May of 1977, and I am sitting in a small, cheap room of the Brewster Hotel in Portland, adding to it. The window is open, and the sound of the traffic floating in seems huge, exciting, and intimidating. I have to look constantly over at the window and reassure myself that there are no bars on it. I sleep poorly at night because the bed in this room, as cheap as the room is, seems much too big and luxurious. I snap awake every morning promptly at 6:30, feeling disoriented and frightened. My dreams are bad. I have a crazy feeling of free fall. The sensation is as terrifying as it is exhilarating. What has happened in my life? Can't you guess? I was paroled. After 38 years of routine hearings and routine denials, in the course of those 38 years, 3 lawyers died on me. My parole was granted. I suppose they decided that at the age of 58 I was finally used up enough to be deemed safe. I came very close to burning the document you have just read. They search outgoing parolees almost as carefully as they search incoming new fish. And beyond containing enough dynamite to assure me of a quick turnaround and another 6 or 8 years inside, my memoirs contain something else, the name of the town where I believe Andy Dufresne to be. Mexican police gladly cooperate with the American police, and I didn't want my freedom or my unwillingness to give up the story I'd worked so long and hard to write to cost Andy his. Then I remembered how Andy had brought in his $500 back in 1948, and I took out my story of him the same way. Just to be on the safe side, I carefully rewrote each page which mentioned Zihuatanejo. If the papers had been found during my outside search, as they call it, at the shank, I would have gone back in on turnaround, but the cops would have been looking for Andy in a Peruvian seacoast town named Las Intrudres. The parole committee got me a job as a stockroom assistant at the big foodway market at the Spruce Mall in South Portland, which means I became just one more aging bag boy. There's only two kinds of bag boys, you know, the old ones and the young ones. No one ever looks at either kind. If you shop at the Spruce Mall Foodway, I may have even taken your groceries out of your car, but you'd have had to have shopped there between March and April of 1977, because that's as long as I worked there. At first, I didn't think I was going to be able to make it on the outside at all. I've described prison society as a scaled-down model of your outside world, but I had no idea of how fast things moved on the outside, the raw speed people move at. They even talk faster and louder. It was the toughest adjustment I've ever had to make, and I haven't finished making it yet, not by a long way. Women, for instance. After hardly knowing that they were half of the human race for 40 years, I was suddenly working in a store filled with them. Old women, pregnant women, wearing T-shirts with arrows pointing downward and a printed motto reading, "Baby Here." Skinny women with their nipples poking out at their shirts. A woman wearing something like that when I went in would have gotten arrested and then had a sanity hearing. Women of every shape and size. I found myself going around with a semi-hard almost all the time and cursing myself for being a dirty old man. Going to the bathroom, that was another thing. When I had to go, and the urge always came on me at 25 past the hour, I had to fight the almost overwhelming need to check it with my boss. Knowing that was something I could just go and do in this too bright outside world was one thing. Adjusting my inner self to that knowledge after all those years of checking it with the nearest screwhead or facing 2 days in solitary for the oversight, that was something else. My boss didn't like me. He was a young guy, 26 or 27, and I could see that I sort of disgusted him, the way a cringing, servile old dog that crawls up to you on its belly to be petted will disgust a man. Christ, I disgusted myself. But I couldn't make myself stop. I wanted to tell him, "That's what a whole life in prison does for you, young man. It turns everyone in a position of authority into a master, and you into every master's dog. Maybe you know you've become a dog, even in prison, but since everyone else in gray is a dog too, it doesn't seem to matter so much. Outside, it does." But I couldn't tell a young guy like him. He would never understand. Neither would my P.O., a big, bluff ex-Navy man with a huge red beard and a large stock of Polish jokes. He saw me for about 5 minutes every week. "Are you staying out of the bars, Red?" he'd ask when he'd run out of Polish jokes. I'd say, "Yeah," and that would be the end of it until next week. Music on the radio. When I went in, the big bands were just getting up a good head of steam. Now every song sounds like it's about fucking. So many cars. At first I felt like I was taking my life into my hands every time I crossed the street. There was more. Everything was strange and frightening. But maybe you get the idea, or at least can grasp a corner of it. I began to think about doing something to get back in. When you're on parole, almost anything will serve. I'm ashamed to say it, but I began to think about stealing some money or shoplifting stuff from the foodway, anything to get back in where it was quiet and you knew everything that was going to come up in the course of the day. If I had never known Andy, I probably would have done that. But I kept thinking of him, spending all those years chipping patiently away at the cement with his rock hammer so he could be free. I thought of that and it made me ashamed, and I dropped the idea again. Oh, you can say he had more reason to be free than I did. He had a new identity and a lot of money, but that's not really true, you know, because he didn't know for sure that the new identity was still there, and without the new identity, the money would always be out of reach. No, what he needed was just to be free. And if I kicked away what I had, it would be like spitting in the face of everything he had worked so hard to win back. So what I started to do on my time off was to hitchhike rides down to the little town of Buxton. This was in the early April of 1977, the snow just starting to melt off the fields, the air just beginning to be warm, the baseball teams coming north to start a new season, playing the only game I'm sure God approves of. When I went on these trips, I carried a silver compass in my pocket. "There's a big hayfield in Buxton," Andy had said, "and at the north end of that hayfield there's a rock wall, straight out of a Robert Frost poem. And somewhere along the base of that wall is a rock that has no earthly business in a main hayfield." A fool's errand, you say. How many hayfields are there in a small rural town like Buxton? 50? 100? Speaking from personal experience, I'd put it even higher than that, if you add in the fields now cultivated, which might have been hay grass when Andy went in. And if I did find the right one, I might never know it, because I might overlook that black piece of volcanic glass, or much more likely Andy put it into his pocket and took it with him. So I'd agree with you. A fool's errand, no doubt about it. Worse, a dangerous one for a man on parole, because some of those fields were clearly marked with no trespassing signs, and as I've said, they're more than happy to slam your ass back inside if you get out of line. A fool's errand. But so is chipping at a blank concrete wall for 27 years. And when you're no longer the man who can get it for you and just an old bag boy, it's nice to have a hobby to take your mind off your new life. My hobby was looking for Andy's rock. So I'd hitchhike to Buxton and walk the roads. I'd listen to the birds, to the spring runoff in the culverts, examine the bottles the retreating snows had revealed, all useless non-returnables, I'm sorry to say. The world seems to have gotten awfully spendthrift since I went into the slam and looking for hayfields. Most of them could be eliminated right off. No rock walls. Others had rock walls, but my compass told me they were facing the wrong direction. I walked these wrong ones anyway. It was a comfortable thing to be doing, and on those outings I really felt free, at peace. An old dog walked with me one Saturday, and one day I saw a winter skinny deer. Then came April 23rd, a day I'll not forget even if I live another 58 years. It was a balmy Saturday afternoon, and I was walking up what a little boy fishing from a bridge told me was called the Old Smith Road. I had taken a lunch in a brown foodway bag and had eaten it sitting on a rock by the road. When I was done, I carefully buried my leavings, as my dad taught me before he died, when I was a sprat no older than the fisherman who had named the road for me. Around 2 o'clock, I came to a big field on my left. There was a stone wall at the far end of it running roughly northwest. I walked back to it, squelching over the wet ground, and began to walk the wall. A squirrel scolded me from an oak tree. 3/4 of the way to the end, I saw the rock. No mistake. Black glass and as smooth as silk. A rock with no earthly business in a main hayfield. For a long time I just looked at it, feeling that I might cry for whatever reason. The squirrel had followed me, and it was still chattering away. My heart was beating madly. When I felt I had myself under control, I went to the rock, squatted beside it. The joints in my knees went off like a double-barreled shotgun, and let my hand touch it. It was real. I didn't pick it up because I thought there would be anything under it. I could just as easily have walked away without finding what was beneath. I certainly had no plans to take it away with me because I didn't feel it was mine to take. I had a feeling that taking that rock from the field would have been the worst kind of theft. No, I only picked it up to feel it better, to get the heft of the thing, and I suppose to prove its reality by feeling its satiny texture against my skin. I had to look at what was underneath for a long time. My eyes saw it, but it took a while for my mind to catch up. It was an envelope, carefully wrapped in a plastic bag to keep away the damp. My name was written across the front in Andy's clear script. I took the envelope and left the rock where Andy had left it and Andy's friend before him. Dear Red, if you're reading this, then you're out. One way or another, you're out. And if you've followed along this far, you might be willing to come a little further. I think you remember the name of the town, don't you? I could use a good man to help me get my project on wheels. Meantime, have a drink on me, and do think it over. I will be keeping an eye out for you. Remember that hope is a good thing, Red, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. I will be hoping that this letter finds you, and finds you well. Your friend, Peter Stevens. I didn't read that letter in the field. A kind of terror had come over me, a need to get away from there before I was seen. To make what may be an appropriate pun, I was in terror of being apprehended. I went back to my room and read it there with the smell of old men's dinners drifting up the stairwell to me. Beef-a-roni, rice-a-roni, noodle-roni, you can bet that whatever the old folks of America, the ones on fixed incomes, are eating tonight, it almost certainly ends in roni. I opened the envelope and read the letter, and then I put my head in my arms and cried. With the letter, there were 20 new $50 bills. And here I am, in the Brewster Hotel, technically a fugitive from justice again. Parole violation is my crime. No one's going to throw up any roadblocks to catch a criminal wanted on that charge, I guess. Wondering what I should do now. I have this manuscript. I have a small piece of luggage about the size of a doctor's bag that holds everything I own. I have 1950s, 410s, a 5-3-1s, and assorted change. I broke one of the 50s to buy this tablet of paper and a deck of smokes. Wondering what I should do. But there's really no question. It always comes down to just two choices. Get busy living or get busy dying. First, I'm going to put this manuscript back in my bag. Then I'm going to buckle it up, grab my coat, go downstairs, and check out of this flea bag. Then I'm going to walk uptown to a bar and put that $5 bill down in front of the bartender and ask him to bring me two straight shots of Jack Daniels, one for me and one for Andy Dufresne. Other than a beer or two, they'll be the first drinks I've taken as a free man since 1938. Then I am going to tip the bartender a dollar and thank him kindly. I will leave the bar and walk up Spring Street to the Greyhound terminal there and buy a bus ticket to El Paso by way of New York City. When I get to El Paso, I'm going to buy a ticket to McNary. And when I get to McNary, I guess I'll have a chance to find out if an old crook like me can find a way to float across the border and into Mexico. Sure, I remember the name. Zihuatanejo. A name like that is just too pretty to forget. I find I am excited. So excited I can hardly hold the pencil in my trembling hand. I think it is the excitement that only a free man can feel. A free man starting a long journey whose conclusion is uncertain. I hope Andy is down there. I hope I can make it across the border. I hope to see my friend and shake his hand. I hope the Pacific is as blue as it has been in my dreams. I hope.
The End.